Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the new phenomenon of a terrorist army and an even more extreme version of terrorism than Al-Qaeda's brand in the form of the Islamic State that has planted its black flag in the heart of the Middle East. One of the world's leading experts on terrorism, Richard Barrett, a director of the Sufan Group, who sits on the board of the International Center for Counterterrorism in The Hague and the Center on Global Terrorism Cooperation in Washington, joins us. We'll discuss the growing appeal of the IS movement, whose vision of a future for the Middle East is the antithesis of the Arab Spring or the Arab Awakening, and try to determine what could be done to encourage a movement for life and counter this movement for death. Then, with the plane crash that killed the leader of Brazil's Socialist Party and six other people, we will look into the shaken political landscape ahead of Brazil's October elections with Paulo Sotero, the director of the Brazil Institute at the Woodrow Wilson Center and the former Washington correspondent for Estado de Sao Paulo, a leading daily Brazilian newspaper. We will discuss the likelihood that the front-runner, President Dilma Rousseff, will have to face a runoff, possibly against another woman, Marina Silva, the late Eduardo Campos's vice presidential candidate, who is of African descent and grew up poor and uneducated to become a prominent environmentalist and a charismatic evangelist who came in second in the last election. Then finally, we will speak with Brian Levin, a criminologist, civil rights attorney, professor of criminal justice, and a former New York City police officer, about the killing of an unarmed African-American teenager by a white policeman in Ferguson, Missouri, that sparked riots and looting and continuing protests against police brutality by a predominantly white police force that serves a predominantly black neighborhood. We will discuss the eyewitness reports that suggest the teenager had his hands up and was not resisting arrest when he was shot several times, and President Obama's call for calm, as well as the Attorney General's statement that the shooting deserves a fulsome review. And joining us now is Richard Barrett, who's the director of the Sufan Group, a New York-based security consultancy company. He's also a senior director for special project at the Qatar International Academy for Security Studies in Doha and sits on the board of the International Center for Counterterrorism in The Hague and the Center on Global Counterterrorism Cooperation in Washington. From March 2004 to December 2012, he was a coordinator of the Al-Qaeda and Taliban Monitoring Group at the United Nations in New York, appointed by the UN General Secretary. In 2005, Richard helped establish the system-wide United Nations Working Group on Terrorism, which became the United Nations Counterterrorism Implementation Task Force. Welcome to Background Briefing, Richard Barrett.
Thank you very much.
And do we have a new phenomenon here that we have, you know, we've had Al-Qaeda, and we've had terrorists, we've had the attack on 9/11, etc., but these tend to be sort of subnational and transnational groups. But now it appears that we have a terrorist army of at least 10,000 people that's controlling an enormous amount of territory in the Middle East.
It's a curious evolution of terrorism over recent years that it has gone from these small clandestine cells sort of setting off bombs in public places in the West to this sort of almost insurgency. And certainly I would agree that in Iraq, Syria, what's happening there is much more like an insurgency than a terrorist organization. And I think that the difference between some sort of regular invading army and these people is that they're prepared to use any tactics, and those tactics may be the tactics of insurgents, they may be of guerrilla fighters, or indeed of terrorists. So I think that's where we get the impression that this is more terrorist than it is sort of an armed insurrection.
But what explains their extraordinary success, their mobility? I can't believe that only 10,000 fighters could take that much territory that quickly.
Well, I think it's two things. It's both the quality of their fighters and, if you like, the lack of quality of the opposition. Their fighters who've come from all over the place, most are, of course, Syrian and Iraqi, but many, many others have come from other countries, are really fired up. They're really motivated. They're really committed to the cause. and they just go for it. And I don't think that that enthusiasm, that hunger for the fight, if you like, is mirrored on the other side, particularly not when the opposing forces don't feel very well led. They're not experienced in this rather unconventional warfare, and they're sort of being attacked suddenly and by surprise by a very competent army.
But we've been led to believe, Richard Barrett, that terrorists that join al-Qaeda, etc., they're aberrant. They're an extreme minority of fanatics. But when you've got this many people, this many recruits flocking to the banner, this many from the U.S., apparently there's at least 200 passport holders in IS from the U.S., 150 from Australia, thousands, I believe, at least 1,000 from Europe. There's a phenomenon going on here, isn't there?
Yeah, it certainly looks remarkable by the figures. But, of course, in percentage terms, it's still a tiny amount. When you think, for example, even if you take the Muslim community of 1.6 billion, we're not talking about very many of them actually taking part in this fight. But nonetheless, it's clear that there is an appeal here. There's an appeal that really resonates with a great variety of people across a huge number of countries. And you mentioned three or four there, but we've counted now 83 different countries from which people have gone to fight in Iraq and Syria. That's an extraordinary number. So what is that appeal? And I think that appeal has both push factors and pull factors. I think there's a lot of people in countries who feel slightly alienated from society, maybe not necessarily that they're outcasts or anything like that, but they just don't feel that they necessarily have a place in the politics of their country, that somehow there may be some discrimination against them, particularly perhaps in Europe. You get that feeling. And there's a certain sort of powerlessness, a lack of identity, a lack of purpose. And on the pull side, the Islamic State is offering all these things. It's saying, look, we're building a whole new world order here. We're doing something which is just in our hands. We're not being told by anybody else, any ex-colonial power or anybody who's sort of a world power now, what to do. We're doing it according to what God tells us to do. Well, of course, it's a complete load of baloney in terms of their interpretation of the Quran, which is extremely twisted and by all Muslim scholars, all respectable Muslim scholars, quite inaccurate. But nonetheless, they're able to say this, and they're able to say it with enough conviction, I think, to appeal to all these people who perhaps are looking for something more in their lives.
Well, one of the things I find extraordinary is that again, rather than being random individuals that engage in suicide bombing, when IS or ISIL were making their lightning advances against the Iraqi army that was basically turning tail and running, when the Iraqi army came back to try and take to Crete from IS, apparently they used suicide bombers as a tactical weapon. They had people on roofs loaded with explosive vests, and they would, on cue, they would jump off the roofs into the narrow alleys below where the Iraqi troops were massing and wipe them all out. And this wasn't just, as I say, this was a part of a battle plan as opposed to, you know, sending some young jihadi off to blow up a mosque or a bus station.
Indeed, yes, and that is certainly a measure of commitment, isn't it, if you're prepared to die fighting and die as part of your fighting in like a suicide bomber, rather than just charge a front line or something. And they use all weapons available to them. They have weapons which are tanks, artillery pieces, and suicide bombers, and suicide bombers have proved extremely effective, of course, and very, very frightening to the enemy because, of course, you don't know who's going to strike you from where and when. And particularly diving off a roof into a group of crowded soldiers is just not something that you're alert to, of course, until it happens. Then once it does happen, of course, you're always scared that it may happen again. So it's a very effective tactic. And I think that it's an exploitation of people who are sufficiently convinced that what they're fighting for is the right thing, that not only are they prepared to die, but in a way they're quite happy to die for the cause. And that's a very, very distressing development.
Again, I'm speaking with Richard Barrett, who's the director of the Sufan Group, a New York-based security consultancy company. He's also a senior director for special projects at the Qatar International Academy for Security Studies in Doha and sits on the board of the International Center for Counterterrorism in The Hague and the Center on Global Counterterrorism Cooperation in Washington. From March 2004 to December 2012, he was the coordinator of the Al-Qaeda and Taliban Monitoring Group at the United Nations in New York, appointed by the UN General Secretary. And in 2005, Richard helped establish a system-wide United Nations Working Group on Terrorism, which became the United Nations Counterterrorism Implementation Task Force. So again, the idea that we thought Al-Qaeda was bad enough, but now we have something that even apparently Al-Qaeda have distanced themselves from the Islamic State. The trajectory, therefore, is in this even ever more scary direction. Is that what we're dealing with here? That it almost as if there's no limit to the kind of, you know, zeal of terrorists. I mean, this is, as I say, they seem to be pushing the envelope, are they not?
Well, they are, certainly, in that they're not only trying, but to a certain extent succeeded in carving out their own territory. And that's what they want to do. Of course, at the moment, they're fixed on Iraq particularly, but Syria as well, and in establishing their presence and complete control over a big chunk of those two countries, if not all of them, and then expanding from that further into the region. But ultimately, of course, their objectives and Al-Qaeda objectives are the same. That Al-Qaeda's methodology may be different, and they may be far less successful right now, but also they would want to see the Islamic State, just as Al-Qaeda, would want to see the elimination of Western influences in Muslim lands, and that they would attack Western countries in order to achieve that. So to that extent, it is pretty scary. But again, let's remember that this is still relatively early days, that, as you pointed out, there are not that many of them, it's one thing to conquer territory and one thing to conquer a couple of small towns along the Euphrates River, and it's another thing to administer territory and offer sufficiently good governance to encourage public support. And I think that that's where their weakness will lie, is in maintaining public support without having to make a lot of alliances with local tribes and so on, which actually are much more secularist and don't share their sort of worldview.
Well, the fact that when they capture government buildings, they paint them black, seems sort of, at least metaphorically speaking, so bleak and such a dark vision of governance.
Yeah, they have a very dark vision. I think that's a nice way of putting it, and they're thinking much more about death than they are about life. But that painting the buildings black or putting their flags up everywhere, and you see this enormous proliferation of flags, it must be a very good business to be in printing Islamic State flags. But that is all part of this very slick propaganda. They're very, very good at projection of their image, and they do it partly through the appalling violence that we see and partly through pretending, at least, that they can offer decent administration. And the black flags are associated with both. You see them waving the black flags as they hack people to death and so on and murder people in cold blood. And you see the black bags on black flags on buildings saying that this is now the center for education, or this is now some other administrative unit, or it's now the factory which is providing bread for the people and so on. So there's this sort of very, very strong brand image they've got, this very, very strong logo they've got. They try to make both tough and soft.
Explain further, if you will. What's the contradiction in the Islamic script?
Well, I don't think there's much contradiction in the way that they see it, in that they will exert violence and publicize their violence to terrify their enemy, so that when they move into a place, people are really scared and likely to shed their uniforms and run away, as happened, as you said, in Mosul. Once they're in there, they will make quick examples of a few people who are clearly enemy. You know, they may be Shia, but they're more likely to be Shia soldiers or Shia police officers or people that the rest of the population can understand that these people would be the enemies of the Islamic State. Having done that, they then present themselves as people who are offering the public a new way of life, which is free of the corruption, free of the bad governance that they've had under the previous regime, if you like, the previous administration of the town or whatever. And so long as the public agree to the rules, which are after all God-given rather than man-given, then everyone will live in fine harmony and everything will be fine and dandy. So there's this sort of undercurrent, this threat of violence, this demonstration of violence, but this offer that, okay, if you go along with us, you're going to be okay. And I think that sort of intimidation, if you like, without necessarily exerting the authority too harshly, is a very carefully calculated sort of projection of what they're all about. I mean, it's horribly menacing, and it's really digressive or regressive in terms of its development of civilization and so on. But it seems at the moment to be moderately successful.
But Richard Barrett, it seems so tragic in a way that there was so much euphoria, perhaps misplaced, and much of it in the West about the Arab Spring. And what I find so sort of grim and ironic here is that the same desires of the young people who took to the streets in Cairo and Tunisia, and also in Syria, for that matter, getting rid of military governments and kleptocratic families like the Assads and the Mubaraks, and being also opposed to the greedy royal families that dominate, that, you know, for example, the Al Saud family basically control the oil resources, and there's no vestige of democracy there. But they do use religion as a way, I guess, to sort of justify their rule. But then you've got this phenomenon now, which is motivated by much of the same impulse, right? Corrupt leaders. But look at the different outcome.
Yeah, that's right. Well, these things don't happen either quickly, easily, or in a linear fashion. And I still believe that the Arab Spring or the Arab Awakening was a wonderful thing, which will have very positive consequences, because before the Arab Awakening, I don't think any of these leaders, whether they claimed to be elected or whether they were hereditary, really gave any validity or whatever to public opinion whatsoever. It was the last thing they worried about was public opinion. If there was a problem with public opinion, they'd just send in their security forces to sort it out, and that was the end of it. But now, since the Arab Awakening, I think there is all these leaders have to take account to a certain extent of public opinion, because otherwise they'll see these movements rise up again. And similarly with these groups like the Islamic State, I don't think that public opinion is going to just sit quietly and put up with it, because whether you have dictatorial rule from an old established family or from a new group of thugs, it's still dictatorial rule. And once you sort of get used to it and assimilate it a little bit, then you start thinking, okay, what can we do to get rid of this? And I think that the example of the Arab Spring, even if we reckon that it's unfulfilled, nonetheless will remain in people's minds and be a good one for both the same generation, but also future generations to follow.
But what, just in closing, what do you do to neutralize the appeal of this dark, murderous vision that IS has of a future, rebelling against the same issues, in effect, and the other more hopeful and more democratic vision of the Arab Awakening?
Yeah, that's true. I mean, these people are saying, look, you can't do it peacefully. You have to do it through use of arms. And that's what we're doing. So come and join us, because we're successful. And the people who are just shouting in the streets are not successful. But of course, people don't necessarily believe that. And people don't like what they see the Islamic State doing. How could anybody reasonable like what the Islamic State is doing? And so that argument is not a very convincing one. And sure, they've been successful. Sure, you can replace one dictator with another, but it's still a dictator. And I think that the appeal that these people have, A, is limited, and B, will be relatively short-lived, because I hope that the states of the region in particular, but the communities of the region as well, will find ways to join together to say, look, one thing we don't want in the future is this. We may not want much about the present, but we certainly don't want this about the future. And that there will be much more community-led engagement in politics and much more pushback against any form of imposed rule.
But then, on the other hand, they could argue, well, look what happened when the Syrian people rose up against the Assad dictator in a democratic and peaceful way. They were slaughtered in the streets. And look what happened in Egypt. The people power took over and then the military came back.
There's no way that these people are going to give up without a fight, that's for sure, on either side. And one of the reasons I think that a lot of the steam went out of the Syrian rebellion was that they just weren't used to any engagement in politics, or they didn't understand how to rebel. They were just so fed up. They felt they wanted to do something, and now it's been hijacked, their rebellion, by these extremist groups. So that doesn't mean to say that they all believe now, well, yes, maybe Assad was better, and we'll go back to living under Assad. But still, the people who are opposed to Bashar al-Assad are still opposed to Bashar al-Assad and want some better political future for themselves and their country. But they don't want the Islamic State or Jabhat al-Nusra or others like that. And I think that we wait, of course. We may wait for a very long time, but we do wait for some sort of demonstration of leadership by people like Assad who say, okay, yeah, you know, this is Syria we're talking about. We're not just talking about me and my family. We're talking about Syria. And the longer this goes on, the more we jeopardize our identity, our national identity, our heritage, and everything that we have built. So one would hope that there's still a chance that Syria can find a way to a better future than it's looking at the moment.
Well, Richard Barrett, I thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Richard Barrett, who's the director of the Sufan Group, a New York-based security consultancy company. He's also senior director for special projects at the Qatar International Academy for Security Studies in Doha and sits on the board of the International Center for Counterterrorism in The Hague and the Center on Global Counterterrorism Cooperation in Washington. From March 2004 to December 2012, he was the coordinator of the Al-Qaeda and Taliban monitoring group at the United Nations in New York, appointed by the UN Secretary General. And in 2005, Richard helped establish a system-wide United Nations Working Group on Terrorism, which became the United Nations Counterterrorism Implementation Task Force. We're going to take a brief station break and back, looking into the death of the leader of Brazil's Socialist Party and how that's going to affect the October elections. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Paulo Sotero, who is the director of the Brazil Institute at the Woodrow Wilson Center. Previously, he was the Washington correspondent for Estado de São Paulo, a leading Brazilian daily newspaper, and has been a regular commentator and analyst for the BBC Radio Portuguese Language Service and Radio France International. He teaches at the Elliott School of International Affairs at George Washington University. Welcome to Background Briefing, Paulo Sotero.
Nice to be with you.
And the loss of the Socialist Party leader, Eduardo Campos, 49 years old, died in a plane crash campaigning in Brazil. He was running third. Who was running first and who's running second? Let's start with that.
Well, President Dilma Rousseff is running first in most polls. Aécio Neves, former governor of the state of Minas Gerais, the second most important state in Brazil, is running second. The loss of Governor Campos, which is a significant event in Brazil, obviously will alter very much the landscape of the October presidential elections.
And would the elections landscape be altered by his successor, the
yes.
vice president, who is a prominent environmentalist, I believe? Didn't she come in second in the last election?
Yeah, that's precisely the reason, Ian. Marina Silva, former Minister of the Environment of the Workers' Party of President Dilma Rousseff, a former senator and a founding member of that party, had ran against Dilma Rousseff in 2010 and obtained some 20% of the vote. She was running ahead of Mr. Campos in electoral simulations done by polling institutions in Brazil. And it was a weird situation where the preferred candidate was running as the vice president with the expected ascendancy of Marina to the post of presidential candidate. Obviously, first it becomes very clear that this will be a two-round presidential election because she will get a significant chunk of the votes, and obviously the event itself of the tragic death of Governor Campos has also an influence in this process. People are really saddened by this. Campos was a leading figure of a new generation of politicians in Brazil, the first generations of political leaders to come from democracy in Brazil since the reinstatement of the rule of law in Brazil in 1985. But she is a significant player, and so we are in a new ball game as far as the presidential elections of October.
And she apparently was supposed to be on the plane, but at the last minute she decided not to travel. Is that your understanding?
That is what I understand, and they were supposed to meet in the resort town of Guarujá near São Paulo. The plane was supposed to have landed there, but it was bad weather, and the plane ended up crashed in Santos, which is the port city adjacent to Guarujá.
So tell me about this father of five children. He'd served two terms as a governor of the northeastern Pernambuco state, and he was a long time, his family, I believe, were long time opponents of the military regimes. What is his political pedigree?
Well, he is he was an economist, but he is the grandson of the late Miguel Arraes de Alencar, who was governor of Pernambuco, founder of the Socialist Party in Brazil, governor of Pernambuco in 1964 when the military took over. Miguel Arraes went into prison first, then to exile, where he lived until the late 70s. He came back to Brazil and was elected governor after in 86. And Eduardo Campos started actually working with his grandfather, later on to the Congress in Brazil. He was also a minister of science and technology under the governor, the government of President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, and he ran in 2006, he ran for governor of the state of Pernambuco, but he really came into view, became a national figure in 2010 when he was re-elected governor by 82%, with 22% of the vote. And that's when the talk started, that Eduardo, who was a pretty charismatic person, and he combined, the charisma of an old-fashioned kind of leader typical of his region, which is the northeastern part of Brazil, with the skills of a modern manager. His state grew consistently 2 to 3 points ahead of Brazilian average GDP, and he was seen very favorably by both Brazilian and foreign investors.
And again, I'm speaking with Paulo Sotero, who is the director of the Brazil Institute at the Woodrow Wilson Center. Previously, he was the Washington correspondent for Estado de Sao Paulo, a leading Brazilian daily newspaper and has been a regular commentator and analyst for BBC's Radio Portuguese Language Service and Radio France Internationale. He also teaches at the Elliott School of International Affairs at George Washington University. So is there a paradox here then, Paulo, that the late Eduardo Campos, the leader of Brazil's Socialist Party, had just died in a plane crash? The fact that he is a socialist but has a business-friendly reputation. He was also a member of the first administration of Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, where he served as a science and technology minister. So being a socialist and being business-friendly often sounds like a contradiction.
And not in Brazil, not in most of Europe. He is in the tradition of social democracy. He was actually a refreshing figure in the Brazilian left because he was a very inclusive type of politician, actually recognizing the merits of both his allies and sometimes his adversary. Once speaking here at the Wilson Center in 2012, he said that, Brazil had gone through a transformation, was going through a transformation that was a result of democracy, economic stability, and what is called social inclusion or reduction of poverty and inequality. And he credited both President Fernando Henrique Cardoso and President Lula for being important participants in this process. So this was obviously a man that thought of Brazil as a nation that wanted to bring people from different political camps continue to build this process of democratization of Brazil. I think that his loss in that sense is a huge one for the country and is one that will make many Brazilians think about, reflect about the meaning of being a politician in the country right now in a very divisive environment. It is obviously a very, very sad event for Brazil.
And what is particularly ironic is it not, Paulo Sotero, that what the night before he died, he was part of a live interview on Globo TV, and apparently he did very well along with his running mate, Marina Silva, and was quite inspiring. He said, alongside Marina Silva, I want to represent your frustrations, your dreams, and your desires for a better Brazil. We will not give up on Brazil. Here is where we will raise our children. Here is where we have to create a fairer society. And apparently he was going up in the polls.
Yeah, he was going up in the polls. It was expected that he would jump a bit. It is, Marina Silva, a black woman, a woman that was illiterate until the age of 14, that is a force of nature, that educated herself with the help of nuns in her home state of Acre in the Amazon. Eduardo Campos, son of privilege, but, of a part of the political spectrum that was persecuted by the military dictatorship. His grandfather, as I mentioned, lived in exile. Actually, I used to see him a lot when he would come from Algeria to Lisbon, where I was a correspondent for a national magazine. So they represent, important positive sides, in my view, of the Brazilian political class. And now it will be up to Marina to bring Eduardo Campos' followers with her and others, and obviously the proof of this or the test will be whether she can surpass Governor Aécio Neves and challenge President Dilma Rousseff in a second round of elections. It would be very interesting to have actually two women running for president in Brazil. It is a possibility. The election is scheduled to take place on October 5th. It will be a very, very intense campaign.
And prior to the death of this candidate who was running third, Dilma Rousseff, the incumbent, of course, was leading in the polls with 36% of the vote. And then Senator Neves, the centrist candidate, who's running second, had 20%. I take it that the change, probably the bump in the polls, whether it's sympathy vote or the fact, as you pointed out, Paolo, that the vice presidential candidate, who has an extraordinary background, Marina Silva, would her rise be at the expense of the centrist candidate, do you think?
I think she will take votes from both from Dilma Rousseff and from Aécio Neves. She will probably take votes even from some of the evangelical candidates. She is herself an evangelical. If you want to see contradictions in Brazil, there are plenty. She is formerly a Catholic, but she is a very religious person, and that combines her religious devotion with this position of leadership she occupies in the Brazilian environmental movement. So it will be a very interesting debate. And again, you know, it is one more indication of the Brazilian political system being able to reproduce itself, in my view, in a positive way, even in tragic circumstances such as the one that we face today.
So just to wrap up then, Paolo Sotero, I wanted to try and get a picture of the vice presidential candidate who will now lead the party, the Socialist Party, who you've described, you pointed out, an even greater contradiction than the late leader of the party, Eduardo Campos, being a business-friendly socialist. Of course, in America, as you well know, the word socialism has been vilified. But so Marina Silva is an environmentalist. She is of African descent. She is very religious, and yet she's an evangelical, even though she's a Catholic. And there is a fairly vigorous evangelical movement going on throughout Latin America as well, usually at the expense of Catholics, is it not?
Yeah, now let me clarify. She was a Catholic. She was educated as a Catholic by Catholic nuns, and she converted to the Evangelical Church, and she is an active member of that church. But she is a Christian, and she is a person that actually reads the Bible daily, etc. That poses problems for her with the part of the left in Brazil that is like and does not like her sort of her persona, as then she doesn't shy away of displaying that persona as a devout, as a religious person. But she is above all a person that focus on issues regarding sustainability, environmental sustainability, economic sustainability. She has a group of advisors, economic advisors, that are very forward-looking people. People that have been trained by American universities or European universities. So it was not an easy coalition, the one between her and Governor Campos. For instance, Governor Campos was much closer to the agribusiness in Brazil than Senator Marina Silva was. You will find those types of contradictions in also in the group supporting Senator Aécio Neves, and even in the group supporting President Dilma Rousseff. The likely emergence of Marina Silva as the presidential candidate brings to this election is obviously an opportunity to debate anew the very complex issues that Brazil faces, and the most complex being the fact that the Brazilian economy has stagnated, and it is a huge task to to get it going again and restarting structural reforms that have not happened in the past few years, and that most economists see as the source of problems that we have now regarding the economic dynamism of the country.
But basically, this contest will be between the sort of the left and further left, I guess, is Dilma Rousseff, right? And the fact that the new leader of the Socialist Party, Marina Silva, is an evangelical, which might hurt her with more traditional leftists, her pedigree, her background as coming out of poverty and being illiterate and educating herself, I think you couldn't have more authenticity than that, could you?
Yes, it is a very interesting, you know, set of circumstances and people. Now, in Brazil, you know, we do not have presidential candidates that are viable as such that come from what you would consider in the United States the more conservative side politically. Governor Aécio Neves is the candidate of the Party of the Social Democracy in Brazil. So you would call him, you can call him center-right or center-left, but it's in more along the lines of social democracy in Europe, for instance. Sure. Marina Silva and Dilma Rousseff come from parties associated more with the left in Brazil. But again, let me stress, this is the democratic left along the lines of social democracy again. Brazilians, I think, would not tolerate reverting back to authoritarian regimes. Brazilians would not tolerate going back to inflationary times. You know, the challenges now are much bigger because we have included 30 to 35 million Brazilians that were formerly poor, are now members of the middle class. These people and that now form the majority. Brazil has 200 million people. We estimate that at least 110 million, 115 million are members of a middle class that is gaining in education, that is demanding more, better, and faster in terms of health, education, public transportation, governance, less corruption, better representation. So it is, you know, a task for good leaders, and we will have now a debate, an intense presidential campaign, and most likely two rounds of vote on October 5th and then on October the 26th between the two candidates that receive most votes in the first round.
Well, Paulo Cetera, I thank you so much for joining us here today. I appreciate it.
Ian, always a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. Again, I've been speaking with Paulo Cetera, who is the director of the Brazil Institute at the Woodrow Wilson Center. Previously, he was a Washington correspondent for Estado de São Paulo, a leading Brazilian daily newspaper, and has been a regular commentator and analyst for the BBC's Radio Portuguese Language Service and Radio France Internationale. He also teaches at the Elliott School of International Affairs at George Washington University. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back talking with a criminologist, civil rights attorney, and former New York City policeman about the killing of an unarmed African-American teenager. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Brian Levin, who's a criminologist, civil rights attorney, professor of criminal justice, and director of the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at California State University, San Bernardino, where he specializes in analysis of hate crime, terrorism, and legal issues. Previously, Professor Levin served as Associate Director of Legal Affairs of the Southern Poverty Law Center's Klan Watch Militia Task Force in Montgomery, Alabama. He was also a New York City police officer in the Harlem and Washington Heights sections of Manhattan during the crack wars of the 1980s. Welcome to Background Briefing, Brian Levin.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, Brian, the shooting of a young African-American man, Michael Brown, an 18-year-old, killed by a police officer in St. Louis County, Missouri. The officer's yet to be identified. Apparently had his hands in the air, was unarmed when he was shot. Obviously, there have been a series of these kinds of incidents for the longest time. And what's your understanding then of this police force in Ferguson, Missouri, in terms of its, I understand that it has something like 50 white police officers and about two or three African-American officers?
That sounds about right. It's predominantly a white police force, but in a town that has been changing demographically and that I believe is now about 70% people of color.
So this is really a case of a community of a tremendous deficit in what's called community policing, right? The idea of community policing is that you have police officers who come from the community, identify with the community, and are therefore comfortable with the people in the community.
Well, and also that there's greater contact. For instance, here in New York, when I'm speaking to you, community patrol, which I used to do actually here, involved getting out into the neighborhoods, not just being in patrol cars. Well, one other thing that I think is really interesting with respect to the St. Louis area, and that is, it is really an amalgam of different towns and small cities in addition to St. Louis. And a lot of this had resulted from white flight from St. Louis over decades. So it's very interesting how there's kind of a hodgepodge of municipalities in the St. Louis metropolitan area.
And so what is your understanding then about the behavior of the police force and not identifying this officer? I mean, there are suggestions that somehow they're doing that to protect him, but it's pretty hard not to take the side of the family of this young man. I mean, it sort of has echoes of Trayvon Martin. Police are not supposed to use deadly force in that way, and you're supposed to be protected by police as opposed to be killed by them.
Well, look, certainly we don't have all the facts yet, but I share both the president's and the attorney general's concern about this, and that's why there's a concurrent federal investigation. But with respect to identifying the police officer, I think at this point, the authorities have a good basis, actually, for not identifying him because of his own safety. That being said, there is a right to know in a democratic society about government officials and their records. And that is something that is on the flip side of this equation. The public is not given an idea about what the individual record of the officer involved in this. But what I would say, because of the extreme tension that is taking place, it probably, from a security standpoint, at least for the officer involved, at least temporarily, good not to have his identity out. Although I think you make an excellent point that when we don't have someone's identity, we also don't have information about their record, and that is something that ultimately belongs in the public domain.
Again, I'm speaking with Brian Levin, who's a criminologist, civil rights attorney, professor of criminal justice, and director of the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at California State University, San Bernardino, where he specializes in analysis of hate crime, terrorism, and legal issues. Previously, Professor Levin served as associate director of legal affairs for the Southern Poverty Law Center's Klan Watch Militia Task Force in Montgomery, Alabama, and he was also a New York City police officer in the Harlem and Washington Heights section of Manhattan during the crack wars of the 1980s. What, though, is pretty damning about this killing of this teenager, Michael Brown, in Missouri is the fact that his friend Dorian Johnson was standing inches away from him when apparently the police car came up beside them. The officer, who hasn't been named, who subsequently shot him, you know, just said, "Get the F off the sidewalk." And then apparently the officer thrust open the door of his patrol car, hitting the two teenagers. And then the officer grabbed Brown around the neck and tried to pull him through the window of the car. And then apparently somehow other, he said, the policeman apparently said, "I'll shoot." And seconds later, the gun went off. And this is all the testimony of this young man who was with him. And apparently this Dorian Johnson is supposed to be interviewed by the FBI, and he's moved out of his apartment, and apparently perhaps he's even in hiding. So this sounds like a pretty convincing eyewitness report. What, as a former police officer, how does it strike you in terms of this eyewitness?
Well, what we have to do is take the totality of the evidence, and eyewitness testimony is very important. Although it's not infallible, what we want to see is what corroborates it. Are there other independent eyewitnesses? What does the forensics tell us? Is there something with respect to any radio transmissions that took place at the time? So look, if the facts as alleged by the witness are true, that is just damning. However, what we have to do is let the investigation run its course and see what kind of corroboration there is from the forensics, from other witnesses, as well as other types of evidence that may come to the surface as the publicity about this case emerges. Oftentimes what we see is there are a variety of pieces of evidence which, when strung together, paint a picture that either corroborates an eyewitness's testimony or may deviate from it as well. And what we have to do is see whether or not there are other independent variables that will paint a composite picture. But look, the reports that have come out from some of these witnesses is just extremely disturbing, and that is why I think we're going to have a thorough investigation with the Attorney General signing off on this. I mean, he made a public statement. We have the FBI investigating this, along with, by the way, the St. Louis County Police, which is separate from the Ferguson Police. What we're going to hope is that, coupled with the medical evidence and others, will give us an emerging picture as to what shall be done from a prosecutorial standpoint, if anything.
So it's you know, the reports, particularly from this eyewitness who was with him, make it hard to understand how this kid could have been killed, how the policeman in this case could be exonerated. I described what Dorian Johnson said in terms of the policeman opening the door and then pulling Michael Brown through the door, and then apparently the gun went off, and then the two of them ran, and then the policeman then fired, which struck Brown in the back. And then Brown, apparently, according to this eyewitness, he turned around and put his hands up. And then the officer fired more shots.
And he was unarmed.
Yeah.
And he was unarmed. Look, bottom line is, the information as alleged by eyewitnesses is incredibly damning. However, being someone who's been on both sides with respect to prosecutions, I do have to caution. Let's have the investigation with independent folks from the Justice Department and the St. Louis County authorities run its course. because we live in a society where the standard is beyond a reasonable doubt. But look, bottom line, the facts as alleged by the eyewitness, and again, eyewitnesses, I'm not saying eyewitnesses necessarily lying, but they might be afraid, they might have a different angle. All this will come up in an investigation where we'll hear from other witnesses, we'll look at forensics, we'll look at medical evidence, but if the facts as they have been alleged early on, if those allegations are true, this is damning, and if true, unless that officer can articulate a defense, this is a very serious matter, up to murder.
But there's no video, right?
That's correct. That's correct. And I think there's going to be, and I think you made an excellent point there, that there is now going to be a push for more video in more places. And again, this is something that even the ACLU has said is a good idea, but not one without some issues for the public at large, because perhaps a member of the public who gets into an interaction with the police might not feel comfortable with that being videotaped. But more and more in our society, we are becoming a videotaped people, whether we like it or not.
Well, we know from what's happened with the L.A. County Jail and the L.A. Sheriff, who has somehow dodged decades of charges of abuse and finally resigned recently. I mean, Sheriff Barker fought tooth and nail to stop the FBI from insisting on having video cameras in the jails. I mean,
and look what a good idea it turned out to be.
Exactly.
The bottom line is, obviously, most police officers do their job quite well, but we have hundreds of thousands of law enforcement throughout the country, and even if a small percentage are misusing the law and indeed killing people without justification, the idea that there are cameras gaining some ubiquity is a good thing for the police, for the public, and I also think for government at large. But the ACLU does say, look, there are issues for the public as well anytime that they get videotaped in their interactions. But I think the trend, as you just so correctly pointed out, is going to be video, audio, all kinds of evidence being used. And we see that now throughout Southern California with the various county sheriffs and local police departments who are routinely videotaping interactions with the citizenry. And I think that's a good idea. I think had we had some videotape here, it would be very helpful. The other thing is it might very well serve as a deterrent for those very few rogue cops who go out and threaten the public.
Well, Brian Levin, I thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Brian Levin, who's a criminologist, civil rights attorney, professor of criminal justice, and director of the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at California State University, San Bernardino, where he specializes in analysis of hate crimes, terrorism, and legal issues. Previously, Professor Levin served as the Associate Director of Legal Affairs of the Southern Poverty Law Center's Klan Watch Militia Task Force in Montgomery, Alabama, and he was also a New York City police officer in the Harlem and Washington Heights section of Manhattan during the crack wars of the 1980s. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Down in America, the guy that lived next door.
Took the kids to the park and disappeared by half.